That's dead, bears!
Bears!
Chill about a little bit! I'm about to die!
Butterscotch
shenanigans!
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 30...
What year is it?
What episode is it?
37.
It's 37,
I'm pretty sure.
You had Butterscotch.
One job, Seth.
The Game Dev Comedy Podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans.
Hey.
I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I make the internet tubes all luby and flowful.
I'm Sam, and I make...
And today is February 2nd, 2016. Is that right? I don't know.
Sure, I don't know.
We're going ballpark on this one. And before we get started, just bear in mind that... We are three adults, and we might talk about adult things and use adult words.
Like swears.
And beer. Yeah.
So if you are, like swears and beer. So if you're a child or a chid or a kid or a child.
Swears and beer, huh?
Then get out and just go out into the fresh air of nature and stop listening to this podcast. All right, so first of all, happy February, guys.
Yeah, February is a good month.
Valentine's Day is coming up. Remember, if all you do for Valentine's Day is buy each other flowers, then you're not thinking about it, and you should feel bad.
That's true. So I was actually thinking about, you know how there's now boxes of, those stupid boxes of chocolates everywhere?
Wait, yeah.
And that's the Valentine's.
I'm a little confused by how you put stupid and chocolate in
the same
sentence.
Hear me out. Hear me out.
You got some explaining to do.
I'm going a place with this. Boxes of chocolates are the worst thing you can buy for somebody when it comes to romance because every chocolate in there is different. It's as if you are saying, I have no idea what you like, so I just got you a bunch of crap in a box. Some of these have coconut in them. Some of them have strawberry.
Some are filled with toothpaste.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's not even that. It's actually worse than that. I think I can get on board with this because what you're really doing is setting up a set of booby traps. Right.
Yeah. One of them is good.
Yeah. Where there's like, I mean, my own experience, like, and I like most things, nearly everything, but still my own experience with those mixed chocolate boxes is that roughly one third of them are things that want to make me vomit.
I think they put garbage inside some of them.
Yeah.
Just to see what happens.
Shards of glass.
Yeah, there's shards of glass.
Those would probably be better than some of the ones I've eaten if they were.
Yeah, but it's my understanding that, you know, romance is all about like deeply knowing a person. And then, like, going out of your way to surprise them and sort of, like, using that knowledge.
I don't know. I mean, from what I've seen from romantic comedies and things, I think it's about stalking a person in really creepy ways.
Oh, you're just thinking of The Notebook. Yeah, I mean, there is that element to romance, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the media has taught me.
But the box of chocolates, man, that's the worst. At the very least, just buy somebody a bag of Cadbury mini eggs.
Fuck yeah.
You know?
Those are good.
I will be your Valentine in that situation.
Exactly. So what's happening on the news front?
I don't know.
How you guys doing? We're now a week and a half ish post launch. How you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good.
I'm okay.
So there's this thing we should talk about.
Let's talk about it.
It's a thing that we don't know what to call it, but for the sake of this, I think for this podcast, we'll call it post-project depression. And it's a thing that sets in where if you've been working on a big project, like a game or an art project or a book.
Or perhaps
whatever,
crafting a baby in your womb.
Making an actual human. Mm-hmm. So there's this thing that happens where your whole life starts to revolve around a particular moment in the future. So having the baby, publishing the book, launching the game, whatever it is. And you're sort of like all your pastimes and your identity and all your free time starts to revolve around getting up to that moment. And then once that moment comes, then there's this big void in your life where now all of a sudden you're not working toward that thing anymore. And you've put so much of yourself into that now you don't know what to do with yourself. And then you just get real sad for a while.
Also, because you stop doing your other hobbies and like various side projects.
You forget how to do other things.
Yeah, you stopped bathing. You lost all your friends.
Yeah, you gained like 80 pounds or so.
And then you lost 90 pounds.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you gained 80 pounds of fat and lost 90 pounds of muscle. At least that's been my experience.
So it's a net loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've become 10 pounds. Just fat on top just of bones. I don't look any
just
different.
Long strands of fat connecting the bones together.
Yeah, I don't look any different at all, but I'm much softer if you like poke me.
I was wondering why. So when I picked Adam up from the airport, I gave him a hug and he just kind of like squooshed. It made a weird noise.
Basically, the parts that weren't being hugged were just then spilling out over.
Yeah, it was real gross, but I didn't want to say anything about it.
Good old Adam Fatty Bones.
Yeah, if you go any further, Adam, your bones will become fat, and then I don't know what.
I think we're on the way. But then I can actually use my arms as tentacles.
Well,
I think getting away from the tentacle arms.
I don't know why you'd want to do that, but
post-Project Depression piece.
Go on.
I think it's something that people don't really talk about too much, and there have been a few indies who, after having some measure of success, which is, I guess, the two blogs that we read the other day were by the guy who made The Stanley Parable and the guy who made Thomas Was Alone. And both of them talk about, very briefly, the consequences of success in both their cases. And I think what people tend to not understand is that either in success or failure, what you end up facing is actually a large change. And if you don't really think about it beforehand, you're going to be just woefully unprepared. And I think it's generally what the post-project depression kind of comes in on. It's about, like you said, Seth, there's a huge void that appears. And then the question is, have you thought about what the hell you're going to do with that void before it actually hits you? Because that's kind of the important part. And if you don't, then you're going to get sort of sucked into it. But if you say, okay, you know, once this game comes out, I'm going to get back to the gym and I'm going to read this book that's been on the back burner and this sort of this. You kind of cobble together enough of a covering that the void, you know, you don't see
it. You just jam a few things into the hole.
Yeah, you just shove it in there and then you're like, okay, this is good
enough.
All
right, I got this filled. Let's do this.
Yeah. And people don't actually talk about it. And I think there's a lot of weird stuff with regards to like finally completing a really big project that ends up being an achievement of sorts, and then being able to talk about how weirdly hard it is afterwards, because it feels like you shouldn't talk about things being hard after you've just done something.
Yeah, people are like, oh, you just made a really cool thing. You don't really get to be sad now, right? But it's like if you worked on a game for, say, 5 years and you put it out there and it's wildly successful, people look at the fact that you have this successful thing out there, but they forget about the fact that you now have nothing to look forward to, like, which is actually a lot more important than like having a successful thing.
The only thing you have to look forward to is death at this point, you know?
Yeah. Now your life is meaningless and you're just going to die. So,
no.
Yeah, I think it's a good skill to be able to constantly keep, you know, giving yourself new challenges and new things to do. And just like, as soon as you're done with a thing, to move on.
This is a problem with and I think this is particularly true of indie studios, and including ourselves in the past, is so much of the focus is on a game, and the studio actually often defines itself by a game. And of course the public does too, because when you make a successful game, then now you're the guys who made The Stanley Parable, as Sam just said earlier, right? You aren't X development studio or X human being, you're the person who made that thing. And so the public sees you that way, but if you also see yourself that way.
Yeah, now you got a problem.
Then you've got a problem, because
now you got to one up yourself.
Yeah, you've got to one up yourself. And we actually, you know, we had this discussion yesterday, as you guys probably recall. Where we were like, what next? Because on the one hand, we can say, well, let's try to keep on building a more amazing, bigger thing every time we put a game out. But like, who the fuck wants that kind of pressure? You know,
a lot of pressure, guys.
The fact that we have tried to switch the focus from us being the people who made Quadrupus Rampage or the people who made Crashlands to being the studio called Butterscotch Shenanigans that makes those games is, I think, the thing that's going to let us just kind of blow by this thing.
Yeah, so I think probably our strategy going forward is we're going to just like make two just garbage pieces of crap.
Yeah, we're going to make the worst games we can, you know, to lower expectations.
We got to really like bring it down a notch so that the pressure comes off.
3 out of 5 stars.
Maximum. Yeah, we're shooting for that like 2-3 out of 5 star range, and then boom, we'll come right back and put out another decent one.
Because that way you guys can be pleasantly surprised about the games we make again. Because otherwise you're just gonna be like, okay, yeah, this is what we expect from a Butterscotch game. It's gotta be good.
So that's not really our plan, but you know, it would work probably.
It might not be your plan.
Adam's going to secretly be blowing our shark.
I'm
going to
sabotage everything.
Adam's going to sabotage it.
Yeah, but I think it's an important piece to talk about. And I mean, if we're generally curious about how people deal with this particular aspect. So if you've completed a big project in the past, even something like a big, you know, school project or anything like that, where it took just a lot of time and then was done on a sort of eventful sort of way and changed how things were going to go forward, feel free to hit us with a tweet telling us how you dealt with it, because we're genuinely curious about how everybody else is handling these things.
If you want more space to talk about it, you can also pop into our forums, which are mostly closed, but the podcast section is open. You can go post there at forums.bscotch.net. You can tell us about it. I mean, this is a problem that Sam and Seth definitely really had to deal with before I was even around. I felt it a little bit when we launched Flop Rocket, but that whole thing was such a weird situation where we kind of accidentally launched it. Then we were at GDC when it launched. It was just everything around it was so weird that I never had to quite
put a hand on it. It was odd.
Yeah, really odd. And then since then, because we've turned the focus around so hard onto focusing on the studio, then I think I might be able to kind of breeze through this whole post-project depression thing without any trouble, because for me, the project is Butterscotch Shenanigans, which never ends.
Right. I think you're right that taking that focus, and then also I think it helps so much that there's actually three of us. Like being a solo dev would honestly be so fucking hard when it comes to this sort of
problem. Mad respect to the people who can pull that off.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Also, if you're successful and you're a solo dev, you should hire at least one support staff.
And a therapist.
And a therapist.
Yeah.
Because it's rough.
Yeah, but I mean, so far I think we're kind of staving this off because we've got the creator patch coming up. We just deployed a bug fix patch. So we, of course, as somebody put it, one of our players put it, you know, you can have 500 testers play for one day, or wait, what was it?
No, it was, you can have one tester play for 500 days, or 500 testers play for one day each, and those 500 testers are going to find way more problems than the one person.
That was the phrase.
Yeah, which is, I'm pretty sure they had a shorter version of that phrase than the one I just said.
But that has come true for sure. We put out, I think, about 2.5 pages worth of patch notes for bug fixes, then a couple smaller follow-up ones, and we got one more coming down the pipe. Hopefully that'll fix all of the sort of remaining problems. Yeah. Then we're going to take a breather, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe slow down for a couple days and then start working on the quality of life patch for Crashlands.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going to hit GDC, which is
the Game Developers Conference
in
San Francisco.
Yeah, so for those who aren't too familiar with it, it's I think there's something like 30,000 game developers go to this thing.
It's crazy.
Well, game developers and people associated with game development.
Yeah, there's press, there's people who work, say, at, you know, Valve and, you know, the App Store, Google Play, PlayStation. Hobbyists.
It's like everything you'd... People who want to get into games but haven't quite gotten there yet, who want to meet people and
see, which is, you know, where stuff. We were a couple years, like the first time we went was 2 years ago.
Well, last year was the first time that people knew that anybody knew who we were.
Yeah, which was just by chance because we'd launched Flop Rocket that same week, and so it was the thing on the App Store. So
I mean, had it been 2 weeks later, everybody would have already forgotten about Flop
Rocket. Yeah, nobody would have.
So that it was
a short, really, short-term memory.
Yeah, weirdly good timing on that one.
Yeah, so that was good. But yeah, so there's also a bunch of talks and just different things for game devs to learn. And it's always really cool to go and hear from, you know, people with a lot more experience and different backgrounds and everything. So we'll be doing that. And also, if you are listening to this and if you're going to GDC, if you are, you know, a streamer, a YouTuber, you know, one of the press or another game dev or whatever, shoot us a tweet or an email or something, and we'll see if we can set up a meeting and
pencil you in. We've got a big document that we're putting in all of our meetings with people.
Yeah. So essentially our meetings are basically going to amount to us
saying hello,
sitting down, drinking a bunch of beer, and then continuing to drink beer.
Also just profanity, to bring it back full circle to the beginning of the episode.
Yeah.
Meetings should just be like that all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't really have an agenda. Like, we just like to meet people and chat and just hear about... It's really interesting to hear about the perspectives of other people in the game dev industry, not just developers, but also people on the press side. And people who work, you know, at, say, you know, Sony, who work for PlayStation, and kind of like their take on how things work. I don't know. It's really fascinating.
Well, to me in particular, actually, it's the YouTuber movement, because it feels like such a new thing, but it's clearly so powerful and is in a lot of where thinking about just the games ecosystem and the press ecosystem around games, so much of it is moving towards streamers and YouTubers. But I feel like I don't know anything about that,
Well, we've been
just like any other market. They have their own market. They're competing with each other. They rely on people who make games, but they also rely on other forms of gaming press. And they have a different kind of relationship with their fans than, say, game developers or written press do.
Sure.
And so I'm really curious to sit down with a few big YouTubers who are turning that into an actual living.
And be like, what?
Yeah, just be like, how the fuck does this?
How does this even go? What are you doing? Yeah, I bet it's really hard.
It must be super difficult. Yeah. I mean, it has to be. It's one of those things, you know, we hear people say, it's kind of like when people say, oh, game development must be so much fun, you just get to play games all day. It's like, no, it's not what fucking happens, right?
That's what being a YouTuber is. But yeah, but, right. But you're really, like, you're not really playing games all day as a YouTuber. You're probably playing games for part of the day, editing for the rest of the day, and then trying to fight off trolls on your comment sections for the rest of the day.
I mean, no, but even when you're playing games, though, you're playing the game as an entertainer. So, I mean.
Yeah, you don't get to chill out. You don't get to relax.
No. We get a lot of requests with Crashlands. We've had so many requests from little tiny YouTube channels and Twitch streamers. And Sam has looked into most of them just to get a sense of what the stream or the channel was about. And I've looked into a bunch. And basically, there are two kinds of people doing it. They're the ones who just literally video themselves playing a game. And that's the end of it. And those are not going to... If you're doing that, you need to look at what these other people are doing who are...
Step it up.
Because what they're doing is they're not selling the gameplay. They're selling themselves. They're selling, you know, their personality and what they're bringing to the game that they're actually playing.
Right.
So they don't get to just play games. They have to just put on... No matter how shitty their day was, they got to put on a ridiculous personality mask and they got to go act, you know?
Yeah, yep. They got to do it every day.
Like every day. Yeah, because they have to put out what, I don't know, 4 videos a day in order for that to be financially successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you compare that to something like, so think about, say, like The Daily Show as an example of like a TV show.
Yeah.
There's a team of writers who orchestrates everything, puts together the content. And yeah, I mean, throughout the day, they're running through it and everything. They have 30 minutes, well, actually 22 minutes that they're live on air. And that's it. That's the extent of them being entertainers, is that 22 minute chunk.
Yeah.
But for a Let's Player, for a YouTuber, it's like,
well, the streamers
4 or 5 hours a day.
Yeah. The streamers one is the one that gets me. Cause like we've done some game dev streaming before. And that shit stresses me out. Like, I get so... Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I'm not even doing anything different than usual. Even if I'm just silently making art in Inkscape, for some reason, after about half an hour, I'm like, I need to turn this off and take a nap. I think it's something about, it's like...
feeling those eyes.
Yeah, watching. checking your speech and regulating yourself actually costs a lot of energy.
Yeah,
and
yeah, it does take a special... It takes a special skill set and talent set, I think, to be able to... maintain that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I would love to, if you're a big YouTuber who's like got this shit figured out, I would love to talk to you and just understand that ecosystem that you live in, because it's just,
yeah, we don't even care if you, like, you know, even if you don't want to play our games, whatever.
Yeah, you can hate our games. I just want to hear about how that world works, and, you know, and we can talk about what we know about how our world works, you know, because in the end, you know, all these different things, I know it seems to a lot of us, new developers, and even ones who've just published a game, that there's a sort of like us versus the press kind of situation where you're just like begging them to review your game and then you're pissed when they give you a shitty review and that sort of thing. But the fact is that we all completely depend on each other. It really is an ecosystem of you know, of codependence. So it's important just to understand the other side's troubles and point of view and the market that they actually work and live in.
Well, let's talk about some of the games that we're playing. Speaking of reviewing games,
let's do it.
So we have a segment in Coffee with Butterscotch called "Here's some games we're playing. Let's talk about that."
I think that's our music for
the segment.
I think what you need to try to do is every time you announce this segment, try to make the title a little bit longer.
All right, next week we're going 2, possibly 3 more words on that title.
Let's just keep doing that until we can make it a fucking...
But brace yourselves, get your pants off, because it's gonna get crazy.
And you're gonna need your pants off.
Yeah,
you just need to have your pants off.
You gotta keep your pants off for the aerodynamics. of what's about to go down.
Of the word storm.
So I've been poking around with a number of games. I spent last week finally going through and getting a bunch of mobile games.
What are those?
That I haven't been playing because I'm generally not interested in what you would consider to be a mobile game. So I decided to finally jump into it. And the first one that I hit was Monument Valley, which has been out for like a year and a half or two.
A little behind the times on this, Seth.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, I have to say, though, holy hell, that is an impressive game.
It's very cool.
Like, so I'm a programmer. I know how programming works. And as I was playing this game, I kept, like, poking around with things in the puzzle, trying to piece together how it happened, like under the hood.
Yeah.
Like
Monument Valley work?
Yeah, like I would rotate a thing and suddenly it's in a different plane of existence. And I'm like, what? Like, what is what's the mechanism by which...
Well, I mean, think about how confusing that is just to, like, think about as, like, looking at a drawing, like an Escher drawing, right?
Yeah, and they
programming that shit. There's another game that's very similar on PC that's significantly older. Do you guys remember that? It's, like, all black and white, kind of, like, style. It's called, like, Bridge.
Yeah.
Something or other.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, same sort of deal. I remember playing that a long time ago where it's all these just mind-bendy puzzles. And that was my thought, too, the whole time I was playing that, was how in the fuck did somebody design and then program that?
I mean, I'm just gonna put this out there. I don't think they programmed it. I think they probably sacrificed animals, probably did a satanic ritual. I don't know what they did, but there is not legitimate programming behind
that.
Yeah,
I think you're right. I think there's gotta be witchcraft. Definitely required some sort of demon or witch involvement.
Well, my favorite part of it, though, is that you know that whoever was coming up for the levels for this thing
was insane.
Well, the crazy thing is, like, you eventually start thinking in terms of the mechanics that are available to you.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like, all of us have had this when we've done level design for a while.
Right.
And so you, like, think about how their brain probably started working after, I don't know, 5 or 10 of these things. Because you see what happens. Like, as the game progresses, the puzzles get more nuts.
Yeah.
And I think the only way to have that actually happen, and something that's as weird and complicated as that, is to have, like, one or two people whose job is just to make the puzzles, because they're going to start figuring out, like, they're going to start seeing the world in Monument Valley terms, and then being able to really, really take advantage of that in a lot of ways. It's really cool.
Oh, man. The world must look really, really weird to those people.
Now, Seth, now I have a question, though.
Yeah.
Is, given that you liked the technical and design aspects of this game, what do you think about all these people who were complaining about the cost versus the time, like the amount of time that it takes to play and complete the game?
So I think anybody who talks about duration of gameplay versus cost is wrong. I think that's a crazy way to look at games, in particular because games are one of the, like, dollars per hour, games are already one of the cheapest forms of entertainment you can get.
Fact.
In part because there's infinite free ones floating around, but...
What if you read really, really slowly?
Well, then apparently the game is worth more to you? I don't know.
Well, I mean, for books, you know, if you're like a terrible reader, then every book is just the best deal ever.
Yeah, but with games are the only...
Which I think Sam's just highlighting how stupid of a metric this is.
It's stupid, yeah. Games are the only mechanism that people look at when it comes to, like, dollars per hour of entertainment. You don't
You know what I want? I know how to speed read, and because I can read 4 times faster than most people,
You should get a 75% discount.
Sam, here's the thing.
I only got 30 minutes of reading.
Soon Amazon's going to be doing that for you, because they're already doing time-based or page-based.
It's going to be page-based, though. It's not going to be time-based.
Well, it's good. I mean, page-based is the next movement. The one after that is going to be time-based.
We talked about this like 20 episodes back. This is coming. Here it is.
Yep.
Here it is.
Well, my prediction is still that books on Amazon are going to become free to read with ads between chapters.
That's going
to
happen.
That's my, and maybe some you know, in-book purchases to, like, buy the next chapter for 99 cents or something.
Mm-hmm.
Unlock audio author commentary.
Although that would be a pretty cool unlock.
That would be annoying as fuck. If you're trying to read, some guy's like, on this page, I wanted to. Yeah, no.
It would be. But yeah, I mean, just imagine somebody going to a movie and being like, yeah, I mean, it was really good, but I was honestly expecting it to be 2.5 hours and it was only 2. So, you know, not really. Yeah, 3 stars, 3 out of 5, whatever, you know, like look at the content. And when it comes to Monument Valley, I think, it took me maybe an hour and a half to get through. And I think it was $4 or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took me 5 minutes to get through.
Which, by the way, way cheaper than a movie, mm-hmm. dollars per hour. But again, dumb metric. It was amazing. Like, it was amazing. I think the puzzles were actually, like, not that hard.
Yeah, as, I mean, as a thing, as like a challenge that you have to rise to, I agree. Like, I didn't find it challenging,
but man,
I found
it awesome.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah, it's fucking amazing. So, it was an experience that was worth having and worth spending a little money on. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then otherwise, so I've been trying to find good space games. I love the idea of space games. I want to play space games. And my God, what is the deal with it's people because, who make space
man,
games?
It's because, God damn it, we've talked about this before, Seth. It's because space is literally a void.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, okay, I will grant you
there
that space...
There is nothing in space. Like,
I will grant to you that space is nothing. That is true.
So when you make a
space game... is literally just you saying a UI game.
Well, that's what it seems to come down to. So I downloaded Sins of a Solar Empire. I think it's one of the...
Who makes that? Do you know who makes that?
I can't remember.
By the way, the people who make Monument Valley the group is called Us2, TWO.
Ah, yeah. So I got Sins of a Solar Empire, very highly rated, recommended to me by a lot of people. So I decided to jump into it. So about 10 o'clock at night, I started playing it and I realized it's a very complicated game because, like all space games, it is extremely unnecessarily complicated. So I was like, I better go through the tutorial. So I click on the tutorial section and lo and behold, there's a whole bunch of volumes of tutorials. And each one is presented in almost like textbook format where they'll be like, here's what this ship does. Click on it. You click on it and you're like, good job, you clicked on it. Now click over here to make the ship go over there. And you do that. And then it's just like one step after another. And it's almost as if I just was reading a book about every single mundane rule of the game. So I had to put it down. I'll probably need to hit it again this weekend. Like I'll just brew up a fresh pot of coffee and sit down and try to get through it. Through the tutorial, and then maybe
that was how I felt good. About EVE Online when I tried to play that a few months ago. I was just like, it felt like the tutorial was the most boring novel in the universe in terms of duration and content.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. Our philosophy with tutorials has always been just let people play the game, period. But as you do it, just add mechanics. So you know, the core essence of any game should, you know, is kind of boiled down into discrete components. And as the person is playing through the game, you will reveal to them new concepts and like new
Although,
ways of playing.
We should note that strategy from a game development side does mean that there will be reviewers who play your game and they play it for less time than is required to basically get access to all the cool mechanics that you put in the game because you've designed it to introduce them over time.
And they're like, this is so simple.
Exactly.
And dumb.
And then they'll complain about how trivially easy of a game it is to use because there's only one thing you can do. And it's like, well, yeah, because you only played it for 20 minutes. Right?
Which, can I just say, so I played XCOM the other mm-hmm. day. Not the new mm-hmm. one, but the first one. Because I was
Space
like,
game. Hell, I haven't played the first one.
Everyone's all about XCOM. So I was like, okay, let's go check this out. And I played for like 4 hours. And my God, is that one of the slowest paced games that I have ever played in my life. And they do a similar thing where they sort of slowly introduce concepts, which is fine. I'm totally cool with that. But the glacial pace which they did so was confusing to me because it wasn't like the game didn't feel like it was already sort of full and interesting after like 2 hours. I mean, they weren't putting stuff in sort of fast enough, it seemed like, to actually suggest that I should keep on playing for the next 2 to 6 hours. I don't even know how long the rest of the tutorial goes because, goddamn, I stopped playing. So, like, and I mean, it was literally 4 hours in, and I was like, I am sort of done with this. This has been confusingly slow. And
Well, Sam, on that note, we should probably talk about that Sunless Sea game. Is that the full name?
Yes.
Sunless Sea, because Sam and I, we were talking about this yesterday or something. I was playing this game about a week ago, and I've played it for probably 3 hours total. Sam's played it for 2 or 3 hours, so similar. Mm-hmm. Seth hasn't played it. Sam really got into it, and I just couldn't. Really for actually the same reasons that Sam you're talking about right now.
Well, so Sunless Sea was something I had on my list for a while. I had a free weekend last weekend. So I played it on Sunday for like 3 hours before the thing expired, and just to check it out. And I love a lot of things about what they did in that game. In particular, the fact that they, like, it's a very sort of fresh in my mind game design concept, because of the fact that they're...
Well, we should take a step back and describe the game.
Yeah.
So what is this game? I know nothing.
The idea is that essentially you're in like an under the earth ocean. Called the Sun Sea.
It's like, right, it's like London, it's kind of takes place in London, but it's like an underground London, because London got fucked is the premise.
Yeah.
So they, London got fucked.
It's steampunky.
So they built underground, upside down London on the bottom.
Which happens to be in an underground ocean, basically.
Right, with all sorts of weird creatures and islands and that sort of thing. And
yeah, it seems reasonable.
But the important thing is not the creatures, actually, it's the fact that there's all these islands that have all these people on them who are doing interesting things. And your job is essentially kind of like a courier slash scout for the London Admiral Agency, and you're essentially going out and figuring out what's going on and then bringing the news back about that. And so the major sort of currency in the game is essentially stories from these different islands and pieces of news, which is really cool.
It's like almost 100% text-based kind of.
Yeah. I mean,
it's beautiful graphics and like a really good-looking game, but your core interaction with the game is basically reading stories.
Right. And it won a bunch of awards for narrative stuff too, which I should
mention. And the stories are great and they're fun.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
And I liked it a lot because they essentially just asked the question. It reminds me of what we did when we made Do You Even Lift, which is our elevator simulator for that game jam, because that was when we asked ourselves the question, what would it be like to make a game that's an elevator sim? And then we just did it and made it fun. And they essentially did a similar thing where they said, what would it be like to actually be the captain of a ship in this sort of weirdly, like in a sense, post-apocalyptic, right? And kind of creepy scenario, and developed all these systems with, you know, your officers, with food, with fear, weapon systems, all these things, and then really bundled it all together around this extremely strong narrative chain. And the weirdest thing to me was the choice to do it in a roguelike fashion.
Yeah.
But
that was basically the problem that I've been having with it.
Well, my biggest problem is actually not necessarily that, but just the fact that... So you have to drive your boat from island to island.
It's a survival game, for sure.
Yeah, it is a survival game. I mean, like, you have to drive your boat, and you're constantly running out of food and fuel. Yeah, and
fast.
The thing that bothered me about it was actually just that I had to drive my boat, weirdly, because the meat and the potatoes of the game, maybe I just didn't get far enough into it, you know, as we've been talking about, but the meat and the potatoes of the game is actually in these narrative bits. And I found every interaction I had once I got to an island, which would be, you know, a few minutes of driving my boat around, every interaction I had was cool and revealed some interesting stuff about the world. But I was left with this weird feeling at the end where I was like, they could have just taken out the boat driving part, honestly. And I would have been, like, I would have loved the shit out of it still. Like, I probably would, actually, because when you have to, like, turn your ship back and go to, like, all the news you picked up while you were out exploring, you essentially don't get anything for it until you turn back and drive your ass back to London.
Wait a minute.
It's the same problem we talked about with like Fallout 4 in the past, right? Which is that there's an adventuring component and a crafting component in Fallout 4. And they actually interfere with each other.
Yes.
And to me, I totally agree that in Sunless Sea, the sort of the boat driving and there's a little bit of boat combat, right? You can fire upon other boats and creatures that live in the water. And there's an adventuring part because you're driving out to adventure to find these stories and stuff. But because you effectively become overburdened, it's, you know, same concept, only here you run out of fuel, but same idea, so you have to go back. All of a sudden your adventuring is cut short, just over and over and over again, so you end up spending a lot of time trying to decide, like, do I have enough fuel to go do the next interesting thing? Or do I have to go back through this bleak territory I've already discovered as fast as I can to get back to a place that is my home base that I know all about so that I can turn all this shit in to get some more fuel.
So right. why do you think the boat driving part is in there?
I think
because you can't sell a pure story game.
Yeah, I honestly think, like, if it was a text-based adventure, which it actually is, honestly, it's a text-based adventure with a boat piloting simulator.
With boat interludes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think Adam's completely right, where it's just as far as marketability, I think you have to not make text-based adventures nowadays.
But it is true, though. I mean, the graphical style that you use is fucking beautiful.
Yeah, the whole thing's super neat.
Yeah.
But actual gameplay is just bleh when it comes to those interludes.
Yeah, like, I like the... like. Honestly, if the boat was about 50% faster, I think I would love the shit out of this game.
Yeah.
Period. Because it's just like, you spend just so much time being in a boat, like, while it is definitely true that it requires a certain mood, right? You got to go into it thinking, I want to look at pretty things and kind of be in the somber creepiness of the moment,
like the sunless sea.
Yeah, and they do a really good job, because like there's a fog that you drive through, there's sort of an insanity meter mechanic, right, all that good stuff, and they do a pretty good job of making you feel
creeped out.
I think a little creeped out.
Yeah. Is this the thing? Like, do all survival games need to have insanity also as a component? Is that just like a stock part of survival games?
I think it's just a subset. I think the thing is, like, none of us like survival games, so we don't really play any of them. But I think the biggest ones, though, things like Ark and what is that one by the Garry's Mod guy?
Rust.
Rust, right? Those ones don't have anything like that at all. They may have hunger mechanics, I'm not totally sure. But those ones are mostly about you competing with the environment with other players. I think when it's a single player game, you kind of need, I think maybe it's that you need a few more ways to limit a person's lifetime, I guess.
You need more ways to kill them, right?
Yeah, and so if it's just hunger and that's the only thing that you're fighting against, then maybe that's just not as interesting.
Well, I guess it's also part of sort of pulling the, in a survival game, you want to make the player feel like they're being pulled in too many directions.
Yeah, and survival games tend to be dark, because you don't have survival games, even though people keep on calling Crashlands a survival game, for example, and it is totally not, because you can't have a survival game that's like really peppy and fun.
And survival is absolutely none of the components of the game mechanics. Right.
Because survival itself is like, that's a thing that's supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. That's kind of its whole goal, is to make you feel on edge the entire time that you're playing the game. So they're kind of at odds with each other. So that's probably why insanity comes in, because survival as a mechanic probably just tends towards the dark.
Yeah.
And well, if you want to make something more interesting, then insanity is a known mechanic that then you can add to it to make it more.
But I think also, I mean, so with regards to Sunless Sea, it's one of those things where I think I would have really loved that game without the survival elements. I mean, maybe it's the same way that we talk about like Don't Starve versus a Crashlands sort of idea, where you take the same idea but remove the darkness from it as far as the constant sense of stress, and just let people go explore. Because I mean, I genuinely want to read all the stories. I just don't want to drive my boat around and have my cast and have my crew eating each other while I try to do it, you know?
Well, and even if they're doing that, that's fine. But the problem is then, and because I put in a good, like when I finally started sort of figuring it out, then my last run was 2 of the 3 hours of playtime that I've put into the thing. And so I had this 2-hour run, which isn't a huge amount of time, but like I read all these stories, and actually almost all the stories that I read were the same ones I'd read in previous runs, because though there's randomization,
there's only so much stuff.
There's only so much randomization. And so then I was like, fuck, I have to read the same stories over again before I can like figure out this game enough and get far enough. Cause you still have to get through those to get enough fuel basically to go further. And so basically what they did is they took a story game where you have to now repeat the stories over and over again. And every time you repeat it, there's a probability that you get to see some new story,
right?
Which fuck, man, like I don't want to read yeah. I don't want to read the first chapter of a novel 10 times in a row and then flip a coin and be like, okay, good, now I get to read the next chapter, right?
Yep, that's like, fair. That's a fair criticism, I think.
Right. But I love all the systems, I just want to say. All the systems.
Like the game is beautiful. Super yeah, cool. I think it's absolutely worth buying and playing, because it's a well-crafted game. It's beautiful. It's really interesting. And I think there, without a doubt, a lot of people, especially people who are interested in narrative games, will get a huge kick out of it. And if you're interested in survival games,
you'll
also get a huge kick out of it. And even if you're not in either of those, just as a game design and as overall sort of thing, it's a totally unique, awesome thing.
Yeah.
And it's worth you spending time and experiencing, because it's a cool experience. Like I wouldn't take back the experience I had with it.
Well, this is actually why. So we talked earlier about what's next for Butterscotch and avoiding the pitfalls that a lot of studios fall into after some success, which is they sort of can't go do whatever they want afterwards, and they don't feel capable of doing that. And this is actually, Sunless Sea was brought up yesterday when we were chatting about just a game that took a very cool like design stance on a particular, you know, thing, which is the sort of boating essentially, and made it like really fun and interesting to interact with. And this actually brought up the possibility of us turning Do You Even Lift into an actual full game, because that game is an elevator simulator, and
yeah, it's super weird.
It would just be so damn fun to like blow that out, and like, you know, it'd take us 2 or 3 months to build like a really crazy version of that that had all sorts of other systems that we haven't even thought of yet because we built it in 48 hours to start with. And so it's, I think it arrived at a good time, I think, also for us to kind of be thinking about something in that vein.
Yeah, so who knows what's coming next?
Who knows? I think this is a good time to say, too, though, that we've been dealing with reviews of our own game, and here we are sort of giving reviews of other people's games. And it's important to just to put out there that, you know, one person's experience with the game is going to be so different from somebody else's because you bring your own stuff to the experience that you should never take someone's review as, like, how you should think about the game.
Yeah,
for sure.
Just want to throw that out there.
Especially if that person starts the review with, I'm not really into this kind of game, so.
Yeah. Which we just, to recap, we just said none of us like survival games, and we just described a really amazing, actually, survival game, but with the end result that we kind of don't like it, right? So you should maybe kind of ignore the negative parts of what we said.
This is something that I think is this peculiar to games? Because I never see... No. Just hear me out. Okay, I never see a professional film critic go, I'm not really into romantic comedies, but here we go. I'm gonna watch this and tell you what I think about it.
Right.
Like, that doesn't really happen. But for some reason...
Well, I think we try to do a fair job of saying, of admitting that we don't like a certain kind of aspect of a game, like a survival aspect or whatever, but we try to bring it back to, like, why it does or doesn't work as a game mechanic itself. But it definitely is the case that we read lots of reviews for other games and our games that basically just start off with the premise, I don't like this kind of game, I'm going to give this game a bad review because it's that kind of game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to say that other people shouldn't play it because I don't.
I'm going to use my platform to fuck this game because it isn't the kind of game that I want it to be.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's a weird thing. Yeah, do you guys want to hit some questions?
Well, let me hit Mark of the Ninja real quick. Just real quick.
Sure, dude.
So for those who aren't familiar, Mark of the Ninja, I think, came out like 3 years ago. I don't know how
old
this is,
but
like, this is apparently, today is just us catching up on games we haven't played for decades. So
it's been a long couple months.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever going to be the case that we're going to tell anybody about a game that just came out.
Yeah, so spoilers, Mark of the Ninja on PC, and it's a stealth game. And they did two really interesting things I want to talk about real quick.
Wait,
so,
do you know who made this?
Clay. So the same guys who did Don't Starve and Invisible Incorporated. They always
is
make
it
good
Clay
stuff.
Is it Clay or Cly?
It's Clay. Rhymes with play, I've been told.
Sure.
So the cool thing about Mark of the Ninja is that in most stealth games, the primary mechanic is vision-based, if not the only mechanic being vision-based, where they're like, oh, stay in the dark.
Right.
In Mark of the Ninja, they take it up to multiple senses, basically. So they do vision, and then they do sound, which they use like a little shader thing to show how far out like a sound shoots out from a thing that you interact with.
Ooh.
So if you like throw your little grappling hook and it clanks onto something, it actually sends out a little sound wave. And if your guard's walking by and his, you know, if his head is in that wave, then he's going to hear the damn thing in silent alarm. So there's that. And they also do like smell. So there's these dogs that walk around who they have the same sort of ring structure around them. And they essentially like if you
smell zone.
Yeah. Like if you get in the smell zone, then you're doomed. And so a lot of that fun stuff. And then the mechanism,
is this like a fast paced game or do you sort of plan out all your actions?
It's a mix. Like you can't plan too far ahead, but you have to, you basically never want to get caught and all your kills are one shot kills. So you have to sneak up and then you click to like activate kill mode and then it gives you basically like a little tiny quick time event where you have to like, you either drag the mouse left or right, usually.
Right.
And that's it. But for some reason, it's extremely stressful. Like, it doesn't need to be more complicated than that because you only have like a second to do it. And so you have to read it and then like drag your damn mouse. And if you like mess it up, then it becomes, you'll still kill the person, but it becomes like a messy kill. And they're like screaming, which of course sends out these large, this large sound wave. It's really neat.
Then the dogs smell the murder. And they
and like, well, you could also like, you can hide bodies and stuff. You grab, like you kill someone, you gotta throw them down like a chute or something. So my only critique of it, which I'll just put out there. So it is a stealth game, and stealth games generally are actually they're sort of a weird mix of a like action platformer oftentimes. In this case, it's basically an action platformer / puzzle game. That's usually what stealth games are, and because you need to figure out kind of where to go to do the thing quietly. And Mark of the Ninja is no different in that regard. And I think the only part where that sort of shows, and I think is a bit less interesting than it could be, is in the loop system in the game, which is that, and again, when we talk about loops in games, we talk about the general structure of a underlying structure of a game, which is a loop, which is I'm going to do
like the concept of progression.
Yeah, basically. I'm going to do an action to get a thing so I can do that action better. So it's, you know, getting more equipment, getting more skills, whatever else.
Leveling up.
And Mark of the Ninja is interesting because the loop system is pretty slow, actually. So it wasn't until I think I played for an hour and a half before I got to choose like another sort of skill to be able to do. And I had gotten like fireworks and a few other sort of smoke bombs and that sort of thing to use during my runs, but they were always given on a like per run basis by the story elements. And so like the one move that I got to choose in that time was like a sort of like spider grip or something like that. So if you're peeking out of a grate underneath the floor and someone walks over it, then you can basically grab them, stab them, and throw them down the chute. So it's super cool, but it didn't quite open up very quickly, I guess. And then when I was looking at that, I was like, oh, okay. Because, I mean, the kind of problem they have is that if everything's a one-shot kill, you have to create new skills, essentially, for the person to be able to use using those loop structures. And so it kind of goes a little slow on that. But other than that, it's really cool. And I really like the overall design of it. And, of course,
the
art is
phenomenal.
Yeah, I did
actually try to play some stealth game. It's one of the, like, they stress me out a lot, stealth games.
Yeah.
So I kind of avoid them. But yeah, but definitely there are a few well-made ones. What's the other clay one?
Invisible Incorporated, which
Invisible
is,
Ink, yeah.
We watched,
so that one I've played not a lot of, but a bit of, and that is another just very cool, well designed, interesting game.
Yeah, well, we actually saw a talk by one of the designers on that at GDC last year, and it was really interesting because he was talking about the general difficulty of mashing the two genres of stealth and turn based together, because it actually is incredibly difficult to make.
Well, it's also procedural, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a procedural turn-based stealth game.
Yeah, it's very weird.
And so, you end up playing like a really unique experience. I haven't actually gotten to touch it, but like all the stuff the guy was talking about as far as how long it took them to figure out how to do it.
Trying it out.
Yeah,
it's very cool.
Clay games are generally just great. So
they're good at what they do.
All right, let's do some questions.
Yeah, let's do some questions. Yeah, dude. So these questions come from podcast.bscotch.net. They are asked by members of the Bscotch ID community and also some anonymous folks get their names into the mix as well.
Well, and their name is just anonymous, though.
Their name, well, they don't actually get their names into the mix, now that I think about it.
But they get their question in the mix.
Yeah, which is what, I mean, that's what counts. Let's be real. And people can also vote on questions. So we just take the most highly voted questions each week and just work our way down the list. So if you want to get your questions in there or vote for other people's questions, then head on over to podcast.bsketch.net and just scroll down to the voting section.
And you know what? If you don't want to, we kind of still wish you would.
Yeah, just change your mind and then go.
Just change your mind and go do
just
it.
Just go over and do it.
Yeah.
So the first question with 12 upvotes comes from Specchio. Question is, you awake in the middle of the night, startled by a noise in the other room. You reach for a procedurally generated weapon from any of your games.
Ooh.
Which would it be?
I would grab.
Well, if it's procedurally generated from one of our games, that means it's only from Quadrupus.
Well, no, because the Crashlands weapon's also procedurally
generated. I think it just kind of means randomly generated in some way.
I would. Yeah. I think I would grab for the Mega Gong.
Ooh, wait, here, quick question though.
What?
Do you know the stats? Do you get to choose the stats, or are the chats? The stats. Are the chat stats chosen the moment you grab this weapon?
I think they're chosen the moment you grab it. It's procedurally generated.
So you don't know what's going to happen.
You just got to grab the shape you want. But here's another question. Can you grab something that's 2D?
It's very sharp. So you have to wear a glove.
This is actually, that infinite blade or whatever the super sharp blade from that book.
Yeah, it's zero atoms across.
Yes.
So it's the sharpest blade that exists.
Atoms across, does that just mean it doesn't exist at all?
It doesn't exist in the third dimension, which means it's as sharp as possible.
Wait, so it's not even made out of, is it made out of two-dimensional atoms?
Yeah.
So
pretty much any game, any weapon from any one of our games
would be sufficient if you could pick it up.
Would work. Yeah, but I think when going for a weapon, the goal should not be to use it. It should be to scare the intruder away.
Absolutely.
Right? Because you don't want to hurt anybody. That violates our don't be a jerk policy.
Well, plus there'd be blood everywhere. And like if you've got carpet, now you've got to clean it up.
Yeah, and that also violates our don't be a jerk policy.
Don't mess up the carpet. And then you've got to explain to the cops why there's a half person bleeding all over the place.
And then when they don't believe you, then you have to kill the cops. And then
it just turns into a thing.
It turns into like a John Wick sort of situation. And 70 bodies later.
Speaking of which, have you guys watched that fucking movie yet?
No. We need to do that.
What is wrong with you? Yeah. Watch that movie. Yeah, it's glorious. I need to do that. And they're making a second one, supposedly.
Oh my God.
His dog's going to get taken again.
No, his dog got killed, Sam.
Well, whatever. Take him to the underworld. Same situation.
The ghost of his dog gets killed. by a ghost mafia.
So he has to go back. He has to kill all the ghosts of the people he killed in the previous movie.
Man, this is going to be a lot of ghosts.
It's actually, so you know, this movie. What you don't know is that Ghostbusters 2 is, or 3, I guess, is actually John Wick 2. They're the same.
That's right.
They're the same movie.
It's an incredible mashup.
Yeah. Next question comes from Anti-Spleen.
Fucking spleens? Fuck spleens.
Also, he hates spleens.
Maybe his spleen ruptured.
Yeah, maybe that's why... removed. Maybe it almost killed him.
It could be. It could also be that maybe he is another organ and there's just a big rivalry going on.
Yeah, it's delivered a spleen, that age-old rivalry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anti-Spleen says, does anything exist at the very edge of a biome? How long would it take to get there? This is about Crashlands, which has very large maps.
Nothing exists at the edge of the biome except the camera stops.
Yeah, so what we can say is, technically, the biomes are limited in size only because we wanted to keep the potential file size of a save file small. So biomes are 65,000 tiles across.
60,000.
Oh, sorry, 60,000. Yeah. 60,000 tiles across comes out to something like, I don't know, high 3 billion of tiles per biome. It would probably take you several hours of running in a straight line.
Well, I think when we calculated it, the minimum time was like 3 hours if you ran in a straight line at baseline speed. And did literally nothing else but run in that straight line until you got to the end.
Yeah, if you totally loaded up on speed potions or something, you could probably cut that.
But
down.
Also, it depends on which direction you go. If you go north and south, the world is actually shorter. It's a rectangular world, right? Or I guess the snippet that you're able to explore, because the tiles themselves are rectangular.
Yeah, so you would want to go up.
Yeah, so if you want to get the edge of the map, get some speed boost potions, speed beast potions, and then run either north.
Well,
or south.
Both actually, speed beast elixir, speed boost potions.
Yes, both of those.
Yeah, and so once you get to the edge, the camera just stops. We just stopped the camera at a certain point, and that's the end of it. So
nothing happens.
Sorry.
Nothing happens yet.
We were thinking maybe if you touched the edge of the screen that the world would just start devouring itself from that side. And then,
which would still be pretty amazing.
It would be like the nothing from the Neverending Story.
I was thinking about this. We were talking earlier about, we of course have a piracy issue because all games in the universe do, but we're talking about things that we could do, like,
to
screw with pirates, right? Because there's a sort of a strategy that a lot of game developers employ, which is they sort of seed confusion by putting out copies of their game that are fucked up in some way. But the more subtly fucked up they are, the better, because then people don't realize what's happening. So we've branded this, and we've looked at a few ways that people are pirating stuff. We know that we can detect it if we choose to, and which means that we could do something about it if we wanted to. But the question is, what do you do? Because if you just block somebody, then they just find a new way around it.
And that's not as fun as slowly murdering
but
their
fun. But if you slowly screw with things so that either they never realize what has happened, or they do, but now it's too late to go back, right? Those can both be really interesting and fun.
So what if we just start deleting tiles?
See, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking actually of invoking the nothing, which for those of you who haven't seen, what was that movie called?
The Neverending Story.
The Neverending Story. You'll be a little confused. But the nothing is basically, it's just, think of it as space supplanting the world, right? So the world is being devoured by nothing. Nothing. So I was thinking, what if just we now have a timer where every certain amount of time we just remove tiles from the edge of the world?
I think the tricky thing to do would actually be to just make the world flood.
Yeah, I was gonna say
become water.
Yeah. So just every pool, just every so often, just gains another ring of water.
not gonna lie, that would be easy to do.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it would actually require fewer resources.
Right, because those are actually non-memory based tiles.
So it'd be like every hour as you like are wandering around, the lakes would be just a little bit bigger. And then pretty soon it's just like your ship just kind of on a tiny little, you know, little island in the middle of the ocean.
So yeah. It would only be, yeah, all you would see would be the various outposts. So if you harvested enough stuff before this happened, then you could, in principle, build bridges to everything. But that's super fucking unlikely, given how far apart all the things are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, although we just are now announcing this publicly, so that's okay. Sort of.
Although, here's a question. What's the probability that pirates are listening to this podcast?
If it's the same probability of them pirating our games, I guess about 97%.
90 to 95%. Pretty good.
Stupid pirates.
All right, next question. Also comes from Anti-Spleen. It's Anti-Spleen Day here on Coffee with Butterscotch. Question is, have the sales so far met or exceeded your expectations for, once again, regarding Crashlands?
I think
we launched a week and a half ago.
Yeah, we kind of talked about this last week a little bit as far as just having not much expectations. You know.
Yeah, I mean, we planned for it to do well. Like, we did everything that we could to make it do well, but we expected nothing to happen, or in a sense that we braced ourselves for that. So, you know, if you don't expect much, then you'll always be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I will say, though, I think probably the fairest way to answer this question in a way that means something, though, is to say, compared to what other games have done, because we were actually looking at other games, right, and asking, like, if we performed as well as games of similar scope and kind of overall attitude, so take, like, Terraria as an example, right? What would launch look like? Now, of course, a lot of this problem is we're the only ones who've launched on three platforms at once with a game you can play the same saves on. Like, there's other weird
and a lot of these other games have been out for years.
Yeah, been out for years. And so we didn't really know exactly what to expect. But what I think it is fair to say that we did, compared to other games that have done well, we actually did less well than I expected, given the sort of general exuberant attitude that the vast majority of our players have had towards this game.
Mm-hmm.
And given our position, like, I mean, we were featured on iTunes, Google Play noted that we existed, though I wouldn't say featured us exactly, right? But Steam actually, like, put us up on their little pop. Like, we had really good market appearance, right? People could find the game. And actually, in fact, if they weren't looking for it, people would see the game. And so given all of that, I actually kind of thought that we did less well than I would have expected given those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair.
But we didn't do poorly by any stretch. Like, we did really well, actually, and are continuing to do well. And actually, so far, it looks like we're less dependent on the launch week than we were expecting.
Yeah, which is great. Well, just by point of comparison, when we did Flop Rocket, Flop Rocket was featured on the front page of iTunes for a week, and it was getting 1.5 million downloads, or it got 1.5 million downloads through that week as a free game. And within 2 weeks of launch, it was down to 1,500 downloads per week. So that's a 1,000-fold decline.
Yeah.
So thankfully, that hasn't happened to Crashlands yet.
It's declined a lot.
Although we're still only like 4 or 5 days out from launch. Yeah. So who knows what it's going
to
look like.
Who knows what happened. But yeah, so I guess so in total, it's hard to know what's going to happen because the numbers, most companies don't publish how their launch went. And they don't do it for a lot of reasons, the little data that we have to go on is just not enough for us to make an educated guess about what realistically could happen. And then further, just the particulars of launching at any given moment, meaning what else is launching at that same time, where sort of the state of the calendar year is, because if it's post Christmas, of course, a lot of people have spent a whole bunch of money and may not be willing to spend money right now.
But if it's pre-Christmas, there's a lot of competition.
There's a lot of competition. Exactly. So it's like, so depending on when you do it, there's all kinds of things
you can't that
can
win.
Really, well, they can always really just dramatically and unpredictably impact what actually happens.
I think I will tack onto that I think the launch, the power of the launch, it was all still good for us. Like, it was all within good margins for us to be, you know, safe for the future. Mm-hmm. Which is very good. But I'm with Adam where I think given the feature coverage that we got, the scoop of the, or the size of the launch was, I think, maybe not as big of a power function as I thought perhaps it would be. But on that same token, the power that we're seeing now in the tail after launch even just a couple days out here is actually much higher than I had thought it would be. So
yeah, we thought the drop off would be much more significant.
Yeah, so that's actually what I'm most excited about, because that means that if it's the difference between essentially having to work around a boom and bust model of revenue and being able to actually count on money coming in the door every day, which is a very different situation as far as like trying to plan stuff or scale up the business or whatever else. So I'm totally happy with where we're at with stuff. But I think it was interesting, because like Scrap Mechanic, which is a really cool game, it's a 3D crafting game where you like build motorized equipment and stuff. So they launched around the same time we did, I think a day before, 2 days before. And there's some Crashlands or some Steam-based service that shows you kind of how many concurrent users are on a thing. And so just out of curiosity, because they were also competing sort of with us on for a lot of the YouTubers who play crafting games, right? And so our stuff was up at the same time, and their videos were always getting a ton more views. And part of it, of course, that like people are just building cool, weird shit. So they're naturally going to have more pull. But I wanted to see what that effect would actually be then on the difference between their launch day and our launch day. And it was something like fourfold. Like, they just sort of crushed us. And then, like, I would look at The Witness, because my question was, okay, like, John Blow, this whole thing's been being hyped for months and months and months, years and years and years. So what does that look like? And that was like... eightfold difference, right? And so it's one of those things where I think we landed in a good spot for this being our first Steam game. I think I'm personally really happy with how everything worked out on mobile, and I think also at the same time it was very humbling to look at other games that launched at the same time and see the scale of difference between what they were able to pull off and what we were able to pull off. And I think that's the point where I'm like, okay, so what,
we got room to grow.
We have tons of room to grow, we
have stuff to learn, and so, although I think a lot of it has to do with just the kind of game it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Or actually, even most of it has to do with that, because the fact is that on PC, a 2D cartoony crafting sort of focused game just can't compete with a 3D builder crafting game where you make vehicles,
right? Physics based vehicles.
Yeah, physics-based, right. Like the difference between those things in terms of what people come to PC gaming expecting is enormous. Right. So having a fourfold difference in launch potency for those things is not terrible. To me, actually the more interesting part is if you compare like the success of Don't Starve or Terraria or the myriad of
right, something a little more compared. The problem is the data doesn't go back that far anymore, because the services,
all we have is cumulative over years.
Yeah,
is all we can look at,
which doesn't mean anything.
But it is interesting though, because those games have a huge, like, they've sold huge numbers of copies now.
Yeah,
which means they have a huge fan base. And in principle, Crashlands is exactly the kind of game, especially for Terraria players, I would suspect, because there's actually a huge amount of difference between Crashlands and Don't Starve, and that they're, one's a survival game and one isn't. But people who are into those kinds of games, and there are many, many of them, you'd think that Crashlands would be their jam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to me, that was the interesting part. I was trying to figure out, okay, well, given that we think that that's true, what kind of level of initial launch week or launch day even success can we get from those particular people? And the problem is we don't even know who they are and if they saw it, right?
Right.
And then there's an additional problem that people who love Don't Starve are going to see Crashlands as kind of an enemy, actually.
Yeah.
Well, people get pretty tribal about things.
They get tribal about it.
If they like one thing, they feel like they shouldn't like other things that, you know, are in that same domain or whatever.
So. Yeah, because it's somehow kind of infringing on it.
So I guess... long and short of it, Anti-Spleen is, it's kind of a mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag.
But it's good. We're good. We're all happy.
It's definitely our best launch yet.
By a good margin.
By a very big margin.
Good margin.
Still a lot of room for improvement. And I also think, you know, with the growth of the community, with B-Scotch ID growth and everything, you know, each game we launch in the future should do better than the last.
Yeah.
So that's really what matters. Okay. So I think that's all the time we have for this week. This has been Coffee with Butterscotch, and thank you all for listening. And once again, if you want to get your questions into next week's podcast, head over to podcast.bscotch.net. We also have forums over at forums.bscotch.net, which are still a little bit on lockdown, there are some places you can post in there.
You can post in the podcast section.
Yep, and you can also join the Crashlands community over at reddit.com/r/crashlands. All right, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.